Welcome to the Buddha Sasana Podcast. This talk was given by Bhikkhu Chintita in Austin, Texas.
When I was in my mid-40s, I began to reflect that I had had little idea of what constitutes a worthwhile life, nor what set of values, goals, or operating principles I might otherwise profitably have embraced to carry me through life. I certainly had lived neither happily nor harmlessly in the world, rather bumbling along with remarkably little reflection and snarled in impulses and problems. Moreover, I had very little I could pass on to my fast-growing kids in the way of wisdom in the hopes that they might do better. I had been living like an elephant in a match factory. I had attained normalcy after a decades-long struggle against that very eventuality. I was living, like most people, a life of quiet desperation. I drank a bit too much each evening, ate chips and watched movies, was getting a little chubby, read mysteries, had my house, car, and carbon footprint, ordered clothes by catalog, went to movies, into the opera with my girlfriend, made love afterwards, worried about the mess the world was in, donated to charities and causes, worried about various tasks at work and about being up to snuff. Worked too hard, got older, and couldn't do anything about any of this. I had been given every early opportunity in this life and had once, as a young man, even taken a particular tiger by the tail and mastered it, venturing where no man had ventured before. But my opportunity this time around was now all but squandered. I began to suspect that there must be a skill to life, just as there is a skill to playing chess, a skill to conducting scholarly research, a skill to buying a cantaloupe, a skill to making sense of daily news in spite of the spin. I imagined I must have come at birth with a handy instruction manual, Little Johnny, registered trademark, operator's manual. But that my parents had lost it. They must have. Where is that skill of life to be found? Who can teach it to me? Dear Abby? Dale Carnegie? Steve Jobs? Friedrich Nietzsche? A good shrink? The Pope? Aha! I awoke one morning. That must be what religion is for. I had a hunch religion must serve some purpose other than to vex scientists and cocky smart alecks with alternative views of the origin of species, of the age of the earth, or of what happens after we die. And it must have a manifestation beyond filling the airwaves with frosty snowmen and ardent herald angels during the season to be jolly. Before this, I had little idea what. My last girlfriend had once told me that I was smart but not wise. So just how does someone who is smart but not wise become both smart and wise? Simple. He reads about people who have proved themselves wise and about what they have had to say or write, and then he thinks about all this real hard. I would one day recognize the importance of reflection and seclusion in this. Reflection can make smart or it can make wise. The difference is that without renunciation, reflection merely makes one clever in a limited way because one has too much at stake in the outcome of what one is reflecting on. But my provisional conclusion at this juncture was to be quite fruitful. A relentless student, I began to procure books in comparative religion and then about specific religions. I was already pretty certain that meditation was a component of the skillful life, for my experiences in that area, while not profound, had suggested deeper possibilities. For instance, of taking responsibility for my own mind rather than leaving it subject entirely to the slings and arrows of external circumstance, no matter how outrageous or unfortunate these may be, or of exercising and developing the long-neglected, mysterious inner qualities I had once recognized in myself as a child. I had read all the way through the Bible a couple of decades earlier, mostly out of curiosity, and seemed to recall a tangled net of inconsistency except for one shining golden egg, the ministry and teachings of Jesus, with his emphasis on personal renunciation, a rich kingdom within, an expansive kindness and service to others, particularly to the least fortunate. Unfortunately, the Christians in my circle of acquaintance seemed to fall short of anything close to this shining example, though one day I would in fact meet such eggs. Instead, my deliberations traveled eastward from the Semitic lands into India and China towards the wisdom traditions of Hinduism, Buddhism, and Taoism. No lesser authorities than the Beatles had gone to India long before to seek spiritual guidance and enlightenment. What's more, my homeland, the San Francisco Bay Area, had long been a hotbed of Buddhism. As a young man, I had been aware of the presence of Suzuki Roshi, the San Francisco Zen Center, and the Tassajara Monastery, though I was not at that time sufficiently curious to investigate for myself. I had even oft eaten of Tassajara bakery bread, produced, I understood, by Zen monks, and darn good bread, delivered to the finest hippie food stores and restaurants throughout the Bay Area. However, I now found myself in the middle of the country, far from such wholesome influences, for I now lived in Austin, Texas. In my reading, I was immediately struck by the simple logic of the Buddha's teaching, which runs something like this. This is the human dilemma, and this is what we do about it. Making no appeal to some questionable divine third party, the logic was impeccably pragmatic, and when I read about said human dilemma, it aligned remarkably with my experience. Moreover, images already inhabited my mind from a source I could not recall of peace, serenity, and wisdom, of gentle, simple-robed monks and nuns meditating in deep forests and on tall mountains, of haiku and rock gardens, of penetrating to the heart of matters. I read widely and dusted off my near-dormant, nearly two-decades-old meditation practice. I read of Zen masters and their crazy wisdom, of Tibetan lamas who lived in caves, of wandering mendicant monks meditating serenely at the roots of trees and living on alms. I read of the path of practice, of the perfection of kindness, compassion, and virtue, of the development of wisdom, penetrating insight into the way things are and into one's own mind and being, and of the serene, blissful dwelling place of samadhi. Except for my tenuous connection through meditation, this was a world apart from what I had experienced thus far in my adult years, yet seemed to call me back from a distant past. I read even more deeply and began meditating at home every day without fail. I began to long for companionship on the path, people with whom I could meditate and discuss Buddhist teachings. I knew there were other Buddhists in a cosmopolitan city like Austin, but first, what kind of Buddhism should I pursue? My reading revealed three options: Theravada, orthodox and severe, Zen, freewheeling and attuned to the rhythms of nature, and Tibetan, mysterious, dark, and colorful. At this point, I did a smart and what seemed might be a wise thing. I drew up a table and listed what I took on the basis of my reading so far to be major distinguishing features of these three major traditions of Buddhism, and marked my level of approval for each feature. I wrote plus if I approved, minus if I disapproved, and zero if I was neutral. With respect to ritual, Theravada got zero, Zen got plus, and Tibetan got minus. For magic, Theravada got plus, Zen got plus, and Tibetan got minus. For sound philosophy, plus, plus, plus. For metaphysics, plus, plus, minus. For optimism, minus, plus, plus. For spontaneity or unorthodoxy, minus, plus, zero. In retrospect, the hubris astonishes me to have thought I was at all qualified to make such evaluations, seeing how they were based on the very folksy notions that had failed to produce in me a satisfactory life so far. I had little inkling of what I would be getting myself into. For instance, under ritual, I assumed that the absence thereof was a good thing and that the presence was bad. So the plus allocated to Zen ritual reflects a positive view of its absence, and likewise the minus given to Tibetan ritual reflects a negative view of its presence. Part of my naivete about Zen was encouraged by reading Alan Watts, whom I assumed was one of the greatest authorities on the matter, unaware that, in spite of his literary abilities and enthusiasm for what he had discovered in Zen, he wasn't. I would later learn that ritual is in fact a quite pronounced feature of Zen Buddhism, but by that time would also have evolved entirely different criteria for assessing these features. Silly as this table is in retrospect, I have never regretted the upshot. I would join a Zen group, for Zen got a plus in every category. I could find no listing in the Austin phone book for Zen Buddhism nor Churches Buddhist Zen, but did find on the internet an obscure article that had appeared in some Austin newspaper a couple of years before and that made reference to a Zen-oriented group facilitated by a Dave, whose phone number I looked up and dialed. The group met at the Quaker Friends Meeting House. Dave had practiced at the San Francisco Zen Center, a Soto Zen Center founded by said Shunryo Suzuki Roshi, who had written a book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, which I procured and read. In the past, I had generally meditated in a plush chair with my knees pulled up to rest on the arms. Now I had to get used to sitting on the floor. I soon procured a zafu to sit on and a zabutan to camp out upon and began to bring them to our Thursday meetings. I learned from Dave that there were in fact four weekly Zen sitting groups in Austin, each of which I would visit in the coming months. A couple of peculiar features of the group closest to home were that we had to do three bows each week, things Alan Watts had explicitly assured me I would not have to do, and 10 minutes of strange walking meditation sandwiched between two meditation periods. A third group followed the teachings of the famous Vietnamese Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh, author of many, many books, some of which I procured and read. The fourth group I only heard about, for they did a lot more bows and chanting than even the first group did, so I let that be. They met at the Clear Spring Yoga Studio. I cherished the years spent sitting and learning in these simple weekly meditation groups in an occasional weekend retreat facilitated by a Zen teacher from California. A new world and a new way of being was opening up for us as we found our way together into these profound practices and teachings. Largely through Dave's encouragement and inspiration, I moved beyond local weekend retreats to travel to other parts of the country to participate in week-long retreats called sesshins. The first of the latter was at the rustic Southern Dharma Center in the mountains of North Carolina, which was led by Reverend Shohaku Okamura, a Japanese master a year older than myself, who was later to become a major influence in my understanding of Buddhism. The stillness, the regularity of the heavy bells calling us to the Zendo meditation hall, and the chime that began and ended Zazen, Zen meditation, the smell of incense, the many robes, and the many hours of deepening concentration all spoke of a world apart. During Zazen, we would schedule Dokusan, brief private interviews with the teacher to discuss practice. My corporate job at this time allowed me a certain amount of vacation time each year, and I began to spend it all in sesshin a couple of times each year. The next spring, I traveled to the San Francisco Zen Center, in particular to Green Gulch Farm above the ocean in Marin County, to sit a sesshin led by Reverend Norman Fisher. This was ritually far more elaborate in form than anything I thought was possible, even among Catholics or Russian Orthodoxists. In fact, I would suffer cultural shock for the next 7 days in silence, since it was a silent retreat, but I was resolved to sticking it out. Shortly after arrival at this particular sesshin, the evening before it actually started, newbies were instructed in the fine art of orioki. Orioki involves a precise ritual process of receiving and eating meals and of cleaning one's bowls and utensils, all in the Zendo seated in meditation position, coordinated in unison with receiving food from designated servers and with chanting. All utensils had to be placed in designated positions and clothware utilized with prescribed wrist motions. Woo, I interjected repeatedly to myself during the course of that week. There were precise ways to enter the Zendo, for instance, leading with the right foot, not with the left, to hold the hands as we walk to our cushions, to bow towards those seated in our row, then to those in the remaining rows, taking care to turn clockwise, and then to sit backwards on our zafus and spin around to face the wall. For lecture, we continued to sit cross-legged, not to raise our knees to our chins if we could stand it. I longed for my school days when not throwing spitballs or passing messages got me by. Service was a complex affair with many bows led by Fisher Roshi in the role of, I would later learn, Doshi, who offered incense initially with the help of an attendant, Jisha, and who also at precise points in the chants would make additional bows or approach the altar to offer additional incense. We, in the meantime, held our chant books in a certain way and were to chant with energy. Behavior outside the Zendo was also similarly regulated. We did not break silence, but bowed upon encountering each other. We could make ourselves tea, but had to sit, not stand, while we drank it, and so on. Each morning at the beginning of service, we chanted something I had not heard before, but which moved me quite inexplicably. In fact, my eyes would tear up and I would get a lump in my throat every time we would intone. All my ancient twisted karma, from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, born through body, speech, and mind, I now fully avow. It was as if my whole twisted past the mistakes I had made, the people I had hurt, the opportunities and energy I had squandered, extending back through my memory of the present life into an unfathomable, remote past beyond memory, loomed menacingly behind me, but as if a door had been opened before me that permitted escape from its marching forward momentum. I had only to acknowledge what had been driving me forward thus far. Most of the participants wore robes, and each of those that did seemed to belong to one of two classes, robes with hair and robes with shaved heads. The robes of those with hair seemed rarely to fit right and seemed to be placed over regular American t-shirts, sweaters, and so on. The robes of the hairless were clearly tailored and included an extra long body of cloth that went over the left shoulder, draping elegantly almost to the floor, and other equally exotic but less visible layers. These were the robes and heads of the priests. The priests had the weird habit of putting on their outer robes only after the first periods of Zazen in the morning, and then only after placing the still-folded robes on their bald heads and chanting together something very exotic about fields and emptiness. Of the hairless, Fisher Roshi seemed to be unique in that his robes were brown rather than black. As said, a minority had no robes, and of these, I seemed to be the lone person in the sesshin who had not known to wear black or highly subdued colors. I wore things like green or blue, thankfully not yellow or orange. Fortunately, I was later relieved to see that digging deeper into their suitcases during the week in search of a change of clothing, other robeless participants came up with increasingly brighter colors, eventually to rival or surpass my own. This was all amazing to me. Why would people do all of this? This was not at all like the Zen described so vividly and accurately by Alan Watts, not like real Zen. It wasn't even cool, and it entailed a lot of bother and stress. And this was on top of the agonizing pains in my knees and back from the unaccustomed long hours of sitting for 7 days. I was already suffering from Zendo stress disorder, though I had to admit that all in all, the retreat was a powerful experience, slowly moving through a still, crystallized world in which the only sound was that of my own nettled thoughts, quieter and quieter day by day. I had arranged for my brother Arthur to pick me up at the end of the retreat. He pulled up dutifully into the parking lot in his pickup truck and leaned out the window, a bearded bear of a man with a cigar in his mouth. With no discernible interest in my spiritual path whatever, he talked and joked as incessantly as always as we drove into San Francisco to pick up our mother and then eat at his favorite steakhouse. Arthur was such a marked contrast to the retreat, I imagine that whatever I had attained during the previous week was undone by the time we had crossed the Golden Gate Bridge. In contemplating during the subsequent weeks the personal challenge to my cultural sensibilities and natural inclination toward the casual, I came up not so much with a resolution about my practice as with a way of arriving at one. The easiest response to this comfort I had felt in this highly ritualized environment would certainly have been, "Balderdash, ritual forms are nonsense. They're a perversion of real Buddhism, of real Zen, or else a cultural artifact of the East Asian cultures in which these ritual forms arose that are of little relevance in the critical thinking West. Ha! Although there is in the West a thriving Buddhist balderdash community, the balderdash response concerned me. How would I know that balderdash was the correct response? if I assume that all of my responses were already always correct, what did I hope to gain from Zen practice in the first place? In what, for me, was an almost unprecedented display of good judgment and early convergence of both smarts and wisdom, I chose to respond the opposite way. I decided to accept as a working assumption that there is a purpose for all these ritual forms and related nonsense that I, in my ignorance, simply had yet to fathom. How could something persist generation after generation with no purpose? Furthermore, the only reasons I could think of not to participate in the ritual forms all had noticeably to do with ego, pride, or self-image, things I knew I was supposed to let go of in Buddhist practice. For these reasons, I made the decision to begin sitting every week with the Zen group that met at the Clear Spring Yoga Studio, which was the Zen group infamous in Austin for its bows and ritual forms that until then I had intentionally avoided. This group would one day grow, with my enthusiastic help, into what is today the Austin Zen Center. I did not yet know it, but the moment of this decision was the moment when I came into alignment with the Buddhist path, the moment when I acquired faith in the Buddhist masters, in the refuges of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, to displace the hubris that I already knew what I was doing. I had decided to accept with a degree of wholeheartedness whatever I was taught by respected Buddhist teachers or texts, at least until I got to the bottom of it in my own experience. There really is no other way to assess the value of something. Embracing specifically the sticking points for me with an open mind and with curiosity would put me repeatedly in direct touch with my tacit assumptions. This policy would sustain an explorer's sense of curiosity, of delight in new possibilities, of awe, of deep reverence, and of a bit of foolhardiness throughout my career of Buddhist practice. Buddhist practice, I had discovered, is not for the timid. It was not that I had become a person of faith. I had only traded one faith for another in choosing to let experienced Buddhist practitioners rather than uninformed presuppositions inform my practice. Refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha is refuge from tacit, unexamined faith. Wait, I have to tell listeners about a series of 10 upcoming podcasts beginning June 19th. I plan to provide a broad introduction to Buddhism called Mindfulness Where Dharma Meets Practice, which will highlight the role of mindfulness in the range of Buddhist practice and understanding. These talks are based, like my other talks, almost exclusively on earliest Buddhist texts, which is as close as we can determine what the Buddha actually taught. These talks will provide a concise and accessible introduction for new students of Buddhism, but may also carry some surprises for advanced students. The series of podcasts will be based on my introductory textbook of the same name, Mindfulness Where Dharma Meets Practice. A parallel video course can also be found on YouTube. Links to all of these resources can be found on my website, bhikkhucintita.wordpress.com. That is my name, bhikkhucintita, written as one word, .wordpress.com. As always, please feel free to contact me with questions at bhikkhucintita@gmail.com. I hope you'll be able to join us for these 10 short but highly informative talks.